This is Tuesday, November 15, 2011. And we are dealing with chapter 16, ladies and gentlemen. And chapter 16 on overhead number 6. And I believe we... No signal, computer? Okay. I can't tell. It's the left one or the right one? All right, well, it is what it is. And we are dealing with carbohydrate metabolism. Yay! I had a little carbohydrate metabolism today. I got out some couple pieces of bread, toasted it, put some creamy peanut butter and some homemade strawberry jam on it with 8 ounces of, 2 pieces, 8 ounces of orange juice, and took a big bite and discovered that the bread was not just whole wheat, but it was rye bread. So peanut butter on rye with strawberry jam. I'm not sure how that all worked out, but it's an interesting combination. But it is certainly carbohydrate. Why did I need carbohydrate this morning, ladies and gentlemen? Why, oh why, do I need carbohydrate this morning? What's the fundamental reason why I need carbohydrate? I'm sorry, what? You're seeing... Provide glucose, exactly right. Now, and others said that as well. What tissues need glucose? But muscle could, but there's one that's completely dependent on glucose. Your brain. So oddly enough, complex carbohydrate is brain food, much more than you might suspect. So, but if you're exercising and you exceed and you use up all your carbohydrate in the first 10 or 15 minutes of vigorous exercise, what in the world is, what's powering your muscle tissue then? If all the carbohydrate's gone, what's powering your muscle tissue? What? Nope, carbohydrate's all gone. That means glycogen included. First 15 minutes or so of vigorous exercise, especially if you don't have any carbohydrate in your gut. Fat, that's exactly right, plus a little bit of protein, a little bit of protein, but mostly fat. That's why long-distance runners have very little fat on them, is because they are using all the fat to muscle their, to power their muscles. So if you have no carbohydrate in form of glycogen, and you're exercising vigorously, why don't you faint? Why doesn't vigorous exercise cause you to faint? Because you have no carbohydrate, all the glycogen's gone. All right. Ever hear of a process called gluconeogenesis? No, yeah, you have. Come on, don't be bashful. Yes, gluconeogenesis. So this appears to be a random walk, but it all has a purpose today because this is all carbohydrate metabolism. We'll get into that eventually. Gluconeogenesis provides carbohydrate from protein sources primarily. And so you have to have carbohydrate for your brain. And since you have no glycogen in your muscles or even in your liver... because of you're exercising before you eat. There's no carbohydrate in your gut, nothing in your liver. Very common circumstance. It's easy to obtain that. It's easily happens, especially someone of your age who skips lots of meals and stuff. You don't have a whole lot of extra glycogen. So gluconeogenesis takes simple amino acids from your blood and other places and converts it into glucose to feed your brain. But if you're vigorously exercising, the ratio of insulin to glucagon changes and prevents the muscles from absorbing the glucose that the liver is making for your brain. Because if you are vigorously exercising, even if you were making plenty of glucose in your liver, it would all be consumed in your muscle tissue if it was allowed to. So muscle tissue absorption of carbohydrate drops, glucose drops during vigorous exercise as your energy level in your blood changes and the glucagon-insulin ratio changes. You leave enough glucose to keep your brain active. Or else we'd all be fainting. I have no idea why this thing isn't working. Let's take a look at the enzyme that's designed to release glucose-1-phosphate from glycogen stores in both your liver and in your muscle tissue. This occurs in both places. Right? So it's called glycogen phosphorylase, and it contains what states? T and R. How can you covalently change the difference between T and R? What's the covalent change for that? Covalent. What? The covalent change. There's a phosphatase that releases the phosphate that might be attached, and then there's also a kinase that adds a phosphate to that same molecule. All right. To that same enzyme. All right. So, yes. Right. It had that four states and two and yeah. Let's see here. It's I think I actually repeat this. It's this thing right here, right? Yeah. Notice the two enzymes that are responsible for the enzymatic shift between the T state and the R state. A phosphorylase kinase adds a phosphate that which then favors the R state, and the phosphoprotein phosphatase releases the phosphate, which then creates a form that favors the inactive state. Notice I say favors. It doesn't exclusively make that happen. All right, we got to keep going here, though. But there are allosteric effectors that do this as well. High values of AMP shift T to R through allosteric effector sites. High values of ATP shift R through T to find R to T through allosteric effector sites to bind T. Now, what in metabolic sense does it mean? Does it make to have AMP high levels of AMP shift T to R? Is R the active site? Is R the active conformation? Is R the active conformation? Say yes. Yes, R is the active conformation. Active phosphorylase means it's releasing what? What is it releasing from glycogen? G1P, which is the energy source, is that right? So low levels of energy in the cell shift allosterically the T to the R, allowing it to become active and releasing glucose, 1-phosphate, which then has a variety of fates. Primarily, however, if it has this allosteric effector, it's probably for internal cellular use. High levels of ATP means that the enzyme is what? That the cell is replete, has plenty of energy, and so it shuts it off. All right, notice a phosphate group attached to SER14. What is a SER14? SER14, quickly, what is it? Serine at what position number on the primary chain? 14, pretty early in all that. Causes that T to R shift like AMP, sort of, and then you get this overall reaction. All right, now we're going to be looking at the next, so we're kind of done looking at glycogen phosphorylase. The glycogen debranching enzyme has two activities. First activity, it shifts a maltotriose unit to a non-reducing end, and then B, it cleaves that alpha, that A actually stands for alpha, 1-6 branch on the remaining glucose. We'll take a look at that graphically in a little bit. And then finally, we have this phosphoglucomutase, which simply is reversibly shifts glucose 6 and to glucose 1-phosphate, this kind of a thing. Let's take a look at, oh, I'm not being active. All right, so, boom. Let's take a look at this. Can I get this any smaller? I can get this, and let me just show the whole slide-only view here. All right, so this is the slide-only view. It takes it up. So this is, in fact, guess what enzyme this does? What enzyme do you think this is? What does it say there? Glycogen enzyme. Now, notice that that enzyme said it had how many activities? Two activities. First activity sounds like we're going to shift this set of three carbohydrates, three glucoses, to the end. Notice, what do you think they call this whole thing? What do they call this fragment right here? If there are a bunch of these fragments, guess what they call it? It was a little Y's. What do they call the Y's? Alpha, limit, dextrins. Alpha, limit, dextrins. So that's what this is. And notice what it says here. This side that's got the alpha 1 to 6 is called the limit branch. Why is that even existing? Because the glycogen phosphorylase enzyme is so big, it can't get into that corner. So there has to be a separate enzyme that can get into that corner and remove that corner. So, single protein, how many activities? Two. First activity, move three of the four, and it's always four, three of the four to the end to make amylose. Second activity does what? Cleaves that 1,6 branch. Cleaves it. All right. Fate of glucose 1-phosphate. Okay, so that's how you get that. Then you have that linear form and it's easily accessible to the glycogen phosphorylase. So all this stuff makes glucose 1-phosphate. So what's the fate of glucose 1-phosphate? Well, virtually all of it gets converted into G6P, then liver. In the liver, glucose is converted to glucose by glucose 6-phosphate, moves in the blood by GLUT2 if you need glucose in the blood. Okay? Sometimes that's not what happens. Sometimes the cell needs it, but it's primarily, the liver is primarily a glucose buffer. Okay? Primarily a glucose buffer. It deals with glycogen metabolism and gluconeogenesis. If that's the case, what's the main energy source for the liver? Turns out the main energy source for the liver is fat and fatty acids. Fat and fatty acids. Fat and fatty acids. That's what the liver's primary energy source is. All right. Oddly enough, the glucose 6-phosphatase is located in the ER. Glucose 6-phosphate must be transported to the ER lumen, hydrolyzed, and then transported back to the cytosol. Is that just not bizarre? Who knows? You would think that glucose 6-phosphatase would be in the cytosol, but no, it's actually in the interior of the lumen. Muscle and other tissue, no glucose 6-phosphatase. Does that mean, here's the bottom line. This statement, muscle and other tissues, no glucose 6-phosphatase. The ultimate implication of that is glucose, as glucose, cannot be exported from muscle cells, or other tissues that do not have this glucose 6-phosphatase. No glucose 6-phosphatase, no glucose transport into the blood. So muscle tissue, even though it has lots of glycogen in it, will never be supplying the blood with glucose. It can supply the blood with other high-energy compounds, like alanine, perhaps lactate, but not glucose. So, only major tissue that provides glucose for the blood is the liver. All right, that's number 7, overhead number 7. Let's keep going, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? More fascinating stuff. Navigator, we go down here. And now then, all this is how in the world do you make glycogen? If we can break it down, which we've studied pretty readily, how do you make it? Well, not surprisingly, that's an enzyme called glycogen synthase. All right. So let's take a look. Glycogen synthesis. First blank is UTP. UTP, uridine triphosphate, just like adenosine triphosphate. It's a high-energy intermediate. So there are a variety of things. Next blank is called priming. The next blank is glycogenin. Glycogenin, huh? At the center of every glycogen molecule is a protein. That protein is relatively simple protein, but that protein must be there nevertheless. It's called glycogenin. Then synthase. Next blank is pyrophosphorylase. UDP glucose pyrophosphorylase. Woohoo! And the next blank after that, number three, is glycogen synthase. Glycogen synthase. Next blank, three blanks after that, is ATP, ADP, and PI. And the next blank is branching. Branching, branching, branching. Branching, 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 branching. All righty then. Do we have all that listed down? You guys all written in, typed in? To all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce pickle on a Sesame Street bun. Everything good? All right. So, to make glycogen means you have to have a high energy substrate. In this case, the high energy substrate in this case turns out to be UTP or UDP glucose. And but the ultimate energy source for this whole process is uridine triphosphate, which it is a transfer of high energy phosphate from ATP. So there's an enzyme that does that. The initiation is the priming aspect of glycogen polymer synthesis. Glucose has to first be attached to a protein. It doesn't have any enzymatic activity. It's simply a core protein, a nucleus, for the glucose to be attached to. Glycogenin. The enzyme that does that is called tyrosine glucotransferase. And so you end up producing a glucose glycogenin dimer. Then this tyrosine glucosyl transferase adds up to 7 more glucoses to that particular glycogenin substrate. So then you end up having a segment of glucoses and glycogenin that the glycogen synthase can act on. Right? But the glycogen synthase requires UDP glucose. How do you make UDP glucose? Well, UDP glucose is made from UDP glucose pyrophosphorylase as the enzyme. Notice what's missing here is, do you have that missing on your blank? There's missing a arrow there. You see that yield sign right here? It's supposed to be there. Do you guys have it? That's some reason it's missing on this overhead. All right, so glucose 1-phosphate. Huh, glucose 1-phosphate. I wonder where they get glucose 1-phosphate from. Where do you get glucose 1-phosphate from? How do you make glucose 1-phosphate? What? Okay. Now, that is actually correct. I mean, that is absolutely true. You do get glucose 1-phosphate from glycogen breakdown. But what are we doing here? What's this whole process that we're doing? What's this whole line here? What are we making? You're making it. Would it make a lot of metabolic sense to use the same glucose we just broke down to make more glycogen? Not really. Okay. But you're absolutely right. He's on the right trail. Because we're using an enzyme that's part of that breakdown system. You recall, notice what we have here. Phosphoglucomutase. Near equilibrium, what is that? Reversible. That means that we have an excess of glucose 6-phosphate, and since we have an excess of glucose 6-phosphate, because we're going to be making glycogen, that means this enzyme is simply, I don't care which way I go, I'll either go forward or I'll go reverse. You tell me whichever one of you there is more of, we'll do the opposite. So all of a sudden, more glucose 6-phosphate shows up, and you go, okay, well, I'm going to make then more glucose 1-phosphate. And with that one glucose 1-phosphate, what do we do? What do we do? We then get to make, combining UTP glucose plus water, we make UDP glucose, UDPPG, 2 inorganic phosphates. That inorganic phosphate is broken down to 2 phosphates to drive the reaction. Notice here I said nuts. Anybody see that? That's an official biochemistry term, okay? You'll see that on the key terms quiz this coming Thursday. Is that correct? Nuts. Actually, nuts is a shorthand for to completion. Drives it to completion by breaking down that pyrophosphate.
All right, provides a high energy reaction for glycogen synthase. Let's take a look at glycogen synthase. Glycogen synthase takes glycogen plus UDP glucose. Notice the arrow is missing there in my overhead again. Glycogen plus 1 plus UDP. This enzyme has a TNR form, just like the glycogen phosphorylase, and can be phosphorylated for regulation. Equilibrium between forms can be shifted by allosteric effectors. And not surprisingly, it's inhibited by ATP, ADP, and PI. That seems odd, but oh well. And it's inactive when phosphorylated. Why does it seem odd? It is true. This is absolutely true. But it doesn't follow a whole lot of metabolic logic on this. If glycogen synthase is making glycogen, is that correct? Right? And yet it's inhibited by ATP. High ATP indicates that the cell has plenty of energy. Is that correct? Yes. And so you would think you'd be storing energy as glycogen if you had high levels of ATP. But there are other factors, other regulatory factors in place other than just the cell needs. This ATP probably indicates that they're dealing with system needs overall. We'll talk about that later. It's inactive when phosphorylated. That's odd. Now, wait a minute. Glycogen synthase is inactivated when phosphorylated. But glycogen phosphorylase, what's its tendency when it's phosphorylated? What is it? Glycogen phosphorylase, is it active when phosphated or inactive when phosphated? Active. So here you have a case where, and we'll see this a little later, as a matter of fact, probably in the next couple slides, where the same kinase phosphates two different enzymes of a system. Phosphating one enzyme turns off the system, phosphating another enzyme of that same system turns it on and creates this sort of covalently controlled balance. Then you also have, since you have a debranching enzyme, you must have to have a what? You have a debranching enzyme, you must have to have a branching enzyme, and there it is. Amylo 1,4-1,6 transglycosylase. Transfer segment must come from a branch that contains at least 11 total glucoses. Let's take a look at here. Here is the whole glycogen glucose 6-phosphate pathway. Let's start here with glycogen. What makes it? Well, you make it from branching enzymes that have been used, the glycogen being made by the glycogen synthase. So glycogen and glycogen branching enzymes make glycogen. Glucose 1-phosphate gets made into UTP glucose, which then gets acted upon glycogen synthase. You make glycogen. Then how do you break it down? Well, glycogen, of course, has to have a debranching enzyme, and then the linear forms are acted upon by... what enzyme is that? Glycogen phosphorylase, which makes glucose 1-phosphate. And then the phosphoglucomutase makes glucose 6-phosphate. Woohoo! I love that stuff. I love how we can follow the carbohydrates through the cell. All right, so... this is very handy to know. I'm not going to ask you to regurgitate it, but you must have a mental map of what's happening with glycogen and glucose 1-phosphate and glucose 6-phosphate. Mental map, because you, in order to have that, if you have that mental map, you then can answer responsibly higher ordered questions. Critical thinking questions, just the kind of questions you're going to get asked by your major professor in graduate school, or your dentist in medical school, dental school, or your attending physician. Higher order skills. Let's go ahead, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? What else is happening here? We have even more detail. Two forms of glycogen control. Overview of contradicting enzyme, covalent modification of contradicting enzymes. We basically have two enzymes that are contradicting each other. By the way, before we get on too far, you see this thing right here? Guess what this and what? Guess what this represents? This is a diagram illustrating what? What am I highlighting in red? Branching enzymes. You got at least 11 glucoses here. It takes these six and adds, creates a new 1,6 branch right there. So you're changing amylose basically into amylopectin right here. All right, so let's take a look at this. I want you to note right here, ladies and gentlemen, there's the heart of it. We're going to be looking at as a paradigm for covalent control for a variety of pathways. I hammer this because once you get familiar with this, you'll recognize the pattern in system after system, in pathway after pathway, in which covalent control is modified by enzymes that add or delete phosphates. Now, let's take a look right here. Do you see what I'm circling right here? What is the enzyme I'm circling? Now, why do they have two boxes for glycogen phosphorylase? Yes, exactly. There is a pool of enzymes in the cell that are called glycogen phosphorylase. A pool. Not all are phosphorylated. Not all are dephosphorylated. There is a relative proportion between dephosphorylated and phosphorylated, and you can move between the relative proportions depending on the activity of the kinases and the phosphatases. So how do you move between these two? How do you change glycogen phosphorylase B into glycogen phosphorylase A? What enzyme does that? Phosphorylase kinase, that's correct. And the difference, of course, is adding that phosphate to it. All right. So, there's phosphorylase kinase right there. We are now stunned to discover that that phosphorylase kinase has how many forms? Two. There's a pool of phosphorylase kinase, a pool, some of which is inactive and some of which is active. Notice it says less active and more active. Are we talking about a scale of activity or a simple switch of on and off? A scale. Let me tell you, I'm going to go off the tracks a little bit. Saturday night, I had friends help me grade the key terms quizzes because I wanted to get them done quickly. So we were watching the Notre Dame football game and grading the multiple choice key terms. One of my friends is a physician, Lily Jardine. And she enthusiastically said, "Oh, I love doing this stuff. Give me a whole stack." All right? Seriously. And so, because she didn't care that much about the football game. But so here she's going through your key terms quizzes. Amazing what happens, doesn't it? You never know who's going to be grading this. At any rate, and she says, "I love doing this stuff." And I go, "Really? That's kind of dull, isn't it?" "Well, yeah, it's routine, but at least I know it's A or not A, wrong or not wrong." Okay? I go, "So?" She says, "So much of what I deal with in medicine is kind of uncertain. Okay? You just don't quite know. You have a pretty good idea. Yeah, it's probably this disease, or this enzyme's bad, or this system's going wrong, and this medicine may help. It helps in 80% of the cases, but 20% it doesn't." And she says, "I love the certainty of grading these things because it's unlike whatever I deal with every day, because I deal constantly with uncertainty. And that's what dentists do, that's what grad students do, that's what physicians do, dealing with uncertainty. And that's why you have to go through such difficult training, is that you can push back, reduce as much as possible the uncertainty dealing with the kind of things you're going to be dealing with.
All right. Well, at any rate, notice this says less active and more active. It doesn't mean that phosphorylase kinase is not active. It just says it's less active if it's not phosphorylated. Now, so notice two forms. It becomes active. It becomes active when it gets phosphorylated. Well, guess what phosphorylates it? What controls it? What chooses whether it's going to get phosphorylated or not? An enzyme called... What is that enzyme called? Protein kinase A. What's the other name for protein kinase A? PKA. That's right. PKA. That's actually more of an abbreviation, but yeah. What's the other title? That's right. Cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase. Boom. Cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase. That's the old phrase, and since I'm an old guy, I want you to remember it. Because it's much more descriptive than protein kinase A. All right, so protein kinase A. Now notice here, if the presence of active protein kinase A turns on the kinase, phosphorylase kinase, which then turns on, and I'm saying more, when I say turn on, it's more like a rheostat. It's more like a dimmer switch. I'm turning it from less on to more on, but I'm not moving from off to on. It's kind of a relative term. I'm moving the proportion more to the active. What turns all this off? What turns all this off according to this? What enzyme is that called down there? Yes, thank you for someone saying that aloud. Phosphoprotein phosphatase 1. If it's active, it removes the phosphate and makes that less active and also acts on the kinase to make it less active. So this phosphatase acts on two or more enzymes. Notice that's why they give it a generalized term, phosphoprotein phosphatase, because it's cleaving the phosphates out of a wide variety of enzymes. Okay, let's take a look at the phosphorylase kinase. That's this thing right here. Activated by phosphorylation and calcium ion concentration. Huh? What? Let's talk about that a little bit. It's a heterotetramer, which means it has four different subunits. The gamma is a catalytic unit. Other sites are regulatory. Alpha beta is phosphorylated activated. Gamma is auto-inhibited by a short segment of sequence. This segment appears to be conformationally moved upon phosphorylation of the alpha beta subunits by PKA. Look at what delta is. What's delta? Lowercase delta is what? What? Calmodulin. That's exactly right. Calmodulin. What does calmodulin do? What's its primary purpose in the body? To capture and hold calcium. It's a calcium measurement tool. Okay? All right, so that's calmodulin. You mean to tell me this enzyme here is turned on by calcium? Yes. Yes, I do. So increased levels of calcium shift this from inactive to active. If you don't understand that, you need to write it down. Increased levels of calcium change this from the inactive form to the more active form, which in turn turns on, moves the glycogen phosphorylase from the inactive form to the more active form. Why do you think calcium would be doing that? If you were a muscle tissue, why do you think that would be advantageous to have calcium levels trigger this shift from inactive kinase to active kinase? What triggers muscle contraction? In calcium release. Calcium concentration from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So it increases, is that correct? Now, muscle contraction, does that require energy or does not require energy? It requires energy, right? Where do you get the energy from? Well, there's a wide variety of places you get the energy from, one of which could be glycogen if you have it in your body, in your muscles. So high levels of calcium, which come from the action, this is in muscle tissue primarily, released by the action of the the action potential to cause calcium to increase in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, causing muscle tissue to contract, which requires more energy. The increased levels of calcium move this to the kinase,
which then moves the phosphorylase to the active form, which starts acting on the glycogen to release carbohydrate as glucose, and then that could be made into energy through glycolysis. So there's that metabolic logic. Does that make sense? So high levels of calcium can alter this proportion, make it more active, which alters this proportion, which makes it more active, which releases glucose, which then can go down the glycolytic pathway and make energy for the contraction that's reflected in the high levels of calcium. This model occurs in muscle tissue primarily. All right, the PP1, the phosphoprotein phosphatase, muscle and liver have different controls. Muscle catalytic unit PP1C is active only when bound to glycogen through glycogen binding unit. Let's see next page. Next page, I'm not all that. I mean, it is an interesting thing. Let's go through here. Muscle, in muscle, regulation of PP1. PP1, look at this. Okay. Let's take a look at it. Let's start here at the bottom. Epinephrine. Notice this is glycogen. There's a glycogen subunit that gets phosphated. Okay. Then you have this is different than in liver. This PP1C binds this subunit and can either make it more active or inactive depending on it. So in this case, this is inactive. And since this thing is designed to remove the phosphate, since it's inactive, the phosphates stay on it. Since this thing is inactive, the phosphates stay on it. So here you go. Epinephrine. Now, epinephrine, do you think if epinephrine is circulating in the bloodstream, do you think you need energy or you do not need energy if the epinephrine is floating in the bloodstream? Need it. So epinephrine acts on protein kinase A to activate it. Okay. Protein kinase A, which turns it on, which then phosphorylates the glycogen phosphorylase. So the glycogen phosphorylase is now activated, and that then increases the breakdown of glycogen to make glucose. So what happens next is, let's go back the other direction. Insulin-stimulated protein kinase can act on the phosphatase, which then removes the phosphate on the glycogen phosphorylase, which decreases the phosphorylation and leading to increased glycogen synthesis. So there are multiple enzyme activities going on that can alter the storage or release of glucose as glycogen. One of which is this. I'm not so much concerned about this particular pathway. It's an interesting one, but you don't need to commit it to memory. Let's go on to the next one. This one we've seen before, is that correct? Do you recognize this? Okay. You understand the phosphorylase kinase and the phosphoprotein phosphatase 1? Let's go on to this one. Now, we've memorized this one, is that correct? Okay. Let's go through it, the regulation of it. This is primarily in the liver, ladies and gentlemen. Primarily in the liver. We'll work our way from the inside out. We'll go here in the center. Here we have two enzymes that are doing opposing things. Glycogen phosphorylase B and glycogen phosphorylase A. There's a pool of glycogen phosphorylase. The purpose of glycogen phosphorylase is it to release glucose or to store glucose. The phosphorylase. Release it or store it? Release it. Adjacent to it is another smaller box that says glycogen synthase A and B, which is a pool of glycogen synthase. The glycogen synthase is designed to release or store glucose. Store it. So in the same line, we have an enzyme that's designed to release glucose, and an enzyme that's designed to what? Store it. Let's see how it's regulated. Okay, let's go to the next level here. Let's look at the phosphorylation system first. There's an enzyme, a pool of enzyme entitled phosphorylase kinase. There's an inactive form and the active form. The active form can act on two separate enzymes. The phosphorylase kinase, when active, acts on the glycogen phosphorylase B and changes it into phosphorylase A, which makes it active. Does that make sense? We've studied that before, is that right? That same enzyme, the kinase, even though it's not named properly, can come over to the glycogen synthase and phosphate it. But when you phosphate the glycogen synthase, that's not turned on, it's turned off, because you can see by that B category. So this is the R form, this is the T form. This is the R form, this is the T form. So the same kinase phosphorylating the phosphorylase turns that on, but turns off the synthase. Does that make metabolic sense? Okay. Now then, what turns on the kinase? The phosphorylase kinase. That's turned on by protein kinase A, also known as cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase, which is, notice the R2C2. When you see R2C2, the only enzyme that you should think of is the PKA. Not PKC, that's completely different. PKA. All right? So, somehow we turn on, what turns on protein R2C2? High levels of what? Those four subunits dissociate into two regulatory and two catalytic. Those two catalytic then begin to phosphorylate all kinds of stuff. In the phosphorylation system, those kinases act on the phosphorylase kinase pool, moves it to active. The active phosphorylase kinase pool then acts on the phosphorylase pool, moving it to active, releasing glucose and turning off the storage form of glucose, storage activity of glucose. All right. Now then, if there's a system to turn something on, there must be a system to do what? Turn it off. How does that turn it off? Well, here we go. Follow this around. Notice this protein kinase A can act directly as well on the glycogen synthase, along with other kinases that are not mentioned here. But this kinase also does the following. I want you to note here, we have two opposing systems acting either above or below this line here. The phosphatase is actively removing the phosphate, turning this on, and actively removing the phosphate and turning that off. It would be nice if we could turn off the off system. How could we turn off the off system? This same protein kinase A comes down here and begins to act on a protein called phosphoprotein phosphatase 1 inhibitor. There's a pool of two forms of that inhibitor, an inactive form and an active form. The inhibitor becomes active when it has an attached phosphate. When that attached phosphate exists, you then have an equilibrium situation showing up between the active phosphatase and an inactive dimer that includes the inhibitor and the phosphatase. So when the inhibitor is phosphated, it forms a dimer with the phosphatase, making that phosphatase inactive. So the same kinase that turns on this cascade comes down here, phosphates the inhibitor, and shifts the equilibrium away from the active form to the inactive form. So the same enzyme turns on phosphorylase and turns off synthase, and also turns off the phosphatase system, which is the reverse of what's happening above. So you turn off the off system. Okay. Now then, what happens when cyclic AMP levels decrease in the cell? What happens? Well, this activity begins to drop. And since this activity begins to drop, I want to tell you a little something about this thing. This thing. Notice the phosphoprotein phosphatase can act on its own inhibitor. The phosphoprotein phosphatase can act on its own inhibitor. And this pool of inhibitor can then move from being phosphated to dephosphated, which shifts the equilibrium toward more phosphatase. Are you getting a headache yet? So there's always a low level of this phosphoprotein phosphatase. There's always a low level. I don't care how active this protein kinase is. There's always going to be a little bit of this available. So it can turn off its own inhibitor. So high levels. So as this kinase activity decreases, then the phosphatase activity begins to predominate, which removes the phosphate on its own inhibitor, increasing dramatically the amount of phosphatase that's available. As soon as this phosphatase is available, what does it begin to do? That's right. It removes the phosphate from the glycogen synthase, making it active. It removes the phosphate from the glycogen phosphorylase, making it inactive. And the two systems then reverse immediately. And you go from releasing of glucose to storing of glucose. This constant balancing act, like a teeter-totter, back and forth, depending on the needs of the cell and the needs of the system. All right? So, read this section in the text. Please, oh please, oh please, read it. You will enjoy it. You will find it fascinating about how the body can so accurately regulate the glycogen metabolism. All right, we'll go ahead here. And we have about two more minutes. I have glycogen metabolism, not surprisingly, controlled by protein hormones. Really? Who'd have thunk that? Insulin and glucagon both synthesized in what tissue? Right. Glucagon is synthesized in response to what kind of blood sugar? Low. Insulin, obviously, is what? Responds to what? High level. Okay. Now, you can split this basically in two. We have a muscle cell, and we have what kind of cell? Liver. Here we have pancreas. Kind of above this imaginary line is the pancreas is responding to what? If it's producing glucose, it's doing what? If it's producing glucagon, it's doing what? Yeah, it says there's low energy level, right? Low glucose. So let's follow this. Glucagon lands on the glucagon receptor, which then produces what? Which then does what? Really? What mechanism does it use to break down glycogen, ladies and gentlemen? Why does high levels of cyclic AMP break down glycogen? Right there. And the high levels of glucose in the liver then respond simply to the high concentration of glucose in the cell and allow it to escape into the blood. That glucose GLUT2 transporter is entirely concentration-based. If there's more glucose in the liver than in the blood, it moves it out. Okay. Does the same thing in the adrenal glands. Epinephrine does the same thing. Notice here, there's the beta-adrenal receptor that increases the what? Glycogen breakdown. Alpha-adrenal receptor does what? Increases the what? Also glycogen breakdown. Really? Really? Yes, because there's a diagram. I need for you to draw something on here. Notice this delta unit right here. What's that delta unit? What's that delta unit? Calmodulin, which means this enzyme is responsive to what ion? Calcium. Both in the muscle tissue from movement, but also in the liver cell by hormone receptor, epinephrine, high levels of calcium, glucose, this kind of thing. Right? We got to go on, and we'll finish this up on tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen.